Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm very delighted to be here with Tim Winton. I don't know how to describe you. You've been up for countless awards, won the Miles Franklin 4 times. You've pretty much reached most of Australia with story and been a mirror to many of us about what it means to be Australian and what it means to live in Australia. Welcome, Tim.
Oh, thanks.
You've been a fairly private man in your writing career. You've done what you had to do. You went out and promoted the books and went back to the coast of Western Australia and got on with it. Why have you taken this turn to write about yourself in this new book, The Boy Behind the Curtain?
I ask myself. I think just it's a matter of age. I think I've got old enough and got into a position where the business of keeping the wolf from the door in terms of going hard and fast is, you know, my conditions of my life have changed slightly. Some people might know that, you know, I started writing really young and publishing very young. So I was, you know, 19 or so, 18, 19. And
it's a very ballsy thing to do, to go out and be a writer.
Well, it's insane. It's what you do if you're a young idiot. You know? And that's what I was. What it meant was that, you know, I started writing really young. I got married really young. I was a parent really young. So I spent my 20s and my 30s just going hell for leather, partly out of excitement, you know, and the exuberance of youth and that fear of, you know, the world's going to end before you get to do the things you want to do. And, you know, I was a child of the Cold War, so there really was that sense that, you know, the world could end at any moment. But also just the fact that, you know, making a living from writing and writing alone and literary fiction of all things is just so difficult, and that just meant that I was just working so hard, you know, just so the momentum was I was just pounding through my 20s and 30s, and there's not much chance to look back and reflect, and I was having family and all that sort of stuff. And so I guess, you know, now at a time in my life where my kids are all grown up and left, and I have a bit more, and the wolf's not quite scratching as fiercely at the door as it once was in terms of keeping the landlord at bay. I just had a chance to look over my shoulder and reflect. And then also, you know, I looked back and I left a big trail, perhaps in a family sense and a friendship sense, but obviously in a work sense. You know, it's a lot of books.
Yes.
And a lot of sort of patterns, or at least a few patterns. And it gave me the chance to look back and think, wow, what was all that about? And, you know, conceding that there were a few sort of patterns in the work, as there are in life and in the way that I interact with my siblings and, you know, relationships that I have as a son and a father and an uncle and whatnot. I started writing these quite a while ago, really, just on the side as a way of explaining myself to myself and asking questions of myself. And maybe it was cheap therapy, I don't know.
Did it ever occur to you, I mean, I don't know whether, as a reader and a lover of literature, the trying to get behind the craft and seeing the writer, it's always been one of those things that I love to do. So when a writer offers up any bits of autobiography, I jump on it and see, you know, is there any clues there, how this happened. As a reader yourself, were there any writers whose autobiographies that you read, or memoirs or snippets, as you've got essays that you read, that gave you that little glimpse behind the curtain Sometimes it's accidental. Sometimes it's just a bad book that lets you behind the curtain.
Yeah.
But did you ever have that? Because I can imagine there are readers right now listening to this going, he's written an autobiography. Awesome. Yeah. I'll be able to get behind the curtain. No, I don't want to see the kid with the gun. I want to see the writer. Did you have that relationship with writers that you admired?
Yeah, I understand the impulse. I mean, it's pure voyeurism. You know, there's nothing in that impulse though that amplifies literature or the writer's work. It doesn't. It's not that revealing. All it is satisfying an impulse to know someone else's secrets, to be on the inside of their life.
Is it only that?
I'm pretty sure. So, I mean, look, I loved to, when I was a kid, when I was a teenager particularly, I revered, Faulkner and Hemingway, and there was this, mountain of material, because they were long dead, and they'd left a big, big trail, and they were huge figures, and And as an adult, I've been to Faulkner's home at Roanoke in Oxford, Mississippi, and I've seen his scribblings on the walls when he was, literally planned out. I think with the book The Town, he planned it out on the wall by the telephone. It's all still up there, And the number that he wrote down, I think during when he got the Nobel Prize for Literature, I think he was taking notes about it when the call came. So it's all that, but it's not actually very revealing.
What about in that sense of they suffer the same madness that I do, in that sort of that we're part of a community here. I can see the weird things that I'm up to represented here in someone else. Is that sort of soothing in any way, or
as a writer?
As a writer, yeah. Just because you have to deal with all the things that go around your writing.
Yeah.
Life happens, and being a writer is a strange thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, so as a writer, when I read other writers' biographies or autobiographies, there is a sense in which there's some fellow feeling there. But the fact is, we all do it on our own, in the same way that we'll die on our own. We'll die in our own way. We're all on our own path. And there are moments of similarity. Sometimes I think there are moments where we make our life or imagine their life similar to ours, just to comfort ourselves, But whether there's anything really in it, I don't know. As a reader, when I read accounts of writers, I think it's just the ordinariness of their struggle that reassures me as a person. And perhaps that's why we have a little bit of a taste for memoir. It's because in a way we're often drawn to extraordinary figures, and yet it's the pretty ordinary things about them that remind us that whatever we do and wherever we are, we're more or less the same creature, that we're all on this journey from the cradle to the grave, trying to figure ourselves out as we go along.
So in the book, you touch on a few episodes in your youth, and it is like having different versions of Tim Winton. So there are many different versions of Tim Winton over the years, and it going right up, I suppose, different things go on in your life. When you look back at the opening essay in this book, it's about you hiding behind the curtain with a gun. How much of that person can you recognise still lingering in you, or is it completely like you're dealing with a character in a book or someone else that you once knew?
Yeah, no, that's an interesting observation and question. I think I am looking back at these various versions of myself, all these iterations that went, to go into making up all the failed models that ended up, producing, the prototypes that produced the gleaming production model that is the grown-up me, We never really got it right, but in the end, they just thought they'd have to roll something out, so that here I am, it's things that we never got right, Yeah, I... there's a little bit of, there's a kind of horror in revisiting some of these things when you realise, you look back at what you've done and what you've been and how limited and sometimes, you know, quite literally, especially in the opening essay, The Boy Behind the Curtain, how creepy I was, and how stuck, how caught in this feeling of besiegement. You know, I just felt like I was under siege. At that time, at 13, we'd moved from Perth to the coastal town of Albany. This is 1973. And so I was about to begin high school in a town that where I didn't know anybody at all. And I think I was just afraid and anxious. I didn't know anybody. The town, everything was different. The weather was wrong. And my dad was a cop, so that sort of marks you out in a different way. And I think I was using that gun as a kind of a way of trying to control my reality, and looking through the gun sight at the world and at these people around me. So that sense of anxiety and defensiveness and besiegement, thankfully I grew out of it within a few months. But and yet, there I have to admit that there's probably a little bit of that boy still left in me. At times, when the world feels just too bewildering and complicated, you know, you have the instinct to retreat and to reduce the world, to literally objectify it, which is what I was doing.
Is this like, if you're looking down the scope, you're in a safe place to observe this new environment you're in.
Yeah.
In the moments where you do run away, in your later life, is the scope the novel? Like, can you actually put society at a distance and a safe distance and observe them in your own space to write about them and understand them in safety? Is there a kind of a...
Oh, I suppose you could make a case for that, but I've never really thought of...
I'm going to do a PhD now.
Yeah. I can understand you can make a case for that. I mean, really, when I feel it's all too much, I just do it geographical. I mean, just get in the car and drive to somewhere remote, you know. Yeah.
Well, it's a wonderful story here when you hand in that manuscript and you just take off across the state trying to hit the state line.
Yeah, I just write, you know, when I finished dirt music, I'd had a gutful of myself. I've had a gutful of everything around me. Everyone around me had a gutful of me, that was for sure. And I just got in the car and drove to South Australia, which, you know, if for those people who, you know, have been to Western Australia, you know, that's a long way. It's a sort of slightly mad thing to do. I've been touring around the last couple of weeks, and yesterday I drove from Canberra to Sydney. I just couldn't believe. I was slightly giggling in the back of the car, thinking that you can drive in half a day from one capital city to another, you know, whereas it takes days to even get out of the state in WA. So I don't think I use the novel as a distancing tool. I think that I actually find writing a novel kind of the opposite. It's more of an act, process of intimacy, where it brings everything closer, if you know what I mean.
But you're not in it. You're in your
no,
work
that's,
room.
No, that's probably true. I'm not.
So eerie in my mind. That novel is seems to me. I'm making assumptions from a reader's point of view, but it seems to be a moment of frustration with so many different things going on in society and in all the things you were doing outside of writing, life and conservation, with what was going on in Western Australia. What was going on in the greater world, and you have this guy run to the top of a high-rise building to take stock, in a sense,
like
a magic mountain.
Yeah. Just a much seedier version.
Yeah, much seedier version.
I've seen critics paint it like that, and I think that, you know, that fits in with their little picture of of me, whether that's the case or not, I don't know. I mean, I thought I wrote that book having observed people who are doing jobs like Keeley, you know, in Airy. I just watching them crash and burn as they just threw themselves against the great wheels of what Bob Ellis calls sadomonitorism, and just wondering how they kept going, and then realizing that they only kept going when you noticed that they kept going. That when you didn't notice them, they were gone because they were just burnt. They'd fallen by the way, they'd had a breakdown, and they'd had a meltdown of some sort. And I guess I'm writing about the world, but I'm not in it. But it takes a lot more participation in a novel than the reader realizes. You know, you've got to generate this thing from some process. I don't know which. I don't even understand where you're summoning it up by some form of concentrated energy, and it's exhausting and it's taxing and mystifying, but it means you're in it. Mm. You know, if you've got no skin in the game, you can't get the thing up and off the runway.
Well, what strikes me as I read through Boy Behind the Curtain is, although you're the furthest reaches or the closest reach, depending on where you sit, of Australia on the coast of Western Australia, you seem intimately involved with what's going on in the whole nation. There are essays here. I mean, being the child that I am, when I first picked up the book, I flicked through and I saw one essay called The C Word, so of course I started there. it's about culture and class and all these sort of things, rather than what I initially thought it was.
Sorry to dash your hopes. Yeah.
The dirty bit. in that book, for years I had a secondhand bookshop. Through the Howard years, I had a secondhand bookshop, and it's one of those great privileges to step outside of humanity. It's the one place where you can be safe to be a complete outsider, and other outsiders come to you. It's a wonderful place. And through the Howard years, I was a nice rant and raver. I had a blackboard out the front which I could write all my ravings on, and abuse the local Liberal voters. And one of the things that struck me was just how great a change Howard's government had made on Australia, and how quickly it had happened. And you made the point many times in speeches and in interviews and also in the book about the reason you're the only one in your family to have gone to, you know, or the first to go to university, was because of Whitlam, who made a massive change to the way in which people saw things in the past. They recognised that some people didn't get the opportunity to change their world. How much of the Howard era, the sort of the turning on its head of the class, or I suppose the consciousness of class, how much damage has been done, and is there do you have any hope and optimism that we can undo some of the things that have been done, especially in the environment we're in now?
That's a big question, and I think it's probably worth remembering that we can't cheat it all home to Howard and the Howard years. It was all made possible by Hawke and Keating as well, where, you know, that sort of the beginning of that notion, the beginning of the sort of monetarisation of the culture to the point where, you know, we now no longer see ourselves as a society, we see ourselves as an economy.
Yeah, that kills me.
And that's quite inimical to the Australian story, the Australian journey. You know, as having been world leaders in recognising the dignity of labour, recognising the intrinsic value of community life, and enhancing community life, and building one another up, protecting the weak. Trying to secure a future for the poor, all of that stuff. The things that made Australia great, the things that made Australia the things that distinguished us, I think, mm-hmm. as a young nation. So yeah, things have changed, and this anxiety about that anyone might bring up matters of class is almost like we belong to a sect that doesn't like to talk about sex anymore.
Yeah.
Except the fact is we all came from an act of procreation. It's that similar madness of denying your origins and making sure that you don't see what is before your eyes. Long Australian history of that, I'm afraid. Do I have hope? Yeah, I think that I think in this last couple of years, many people who aren't economists, who aren't in the money market, who aren't sort of economic geniuses, have started to figure out for themselves that this grand experiment, which is a generation long now, hasn't quite been what it was sold to us as. Mm. It hasn't made the country richer. It hasn't made the country fairer. It hasn't made the country any more efficient or productive. And I think, having been sold the idea of trickle-down economics, all we've seen is the fact that the only thing that trickles down is trouble.
Yeah.
But hey, there's no drama according to the orthodoxy, because there's money in trouble. Mm-hmm. When you produce conditions that make people poor and desperate and dysfunctional, and they go to jail, we've privatised punishment. So there's money in putting kids in spit hoods. There's money in putting criminals in jail, and there's money putting children behind barbed wire in offshore hellholes. Mm-hmm. In that sense, after financial collapses, scandals where the people who create the financial collapses are rewarded, not punished. Mm-hmm. I think people are kind of cottoning on the fact that this is a bit of a con. So how we regroup is still an open question. I don't think it's going to be a class war. I don't think there's going to be any revolution. But I think that we might. What I'm seeing is this sort of impulse toward reclaiming some of the social democracy that we still have in our DNA and that our parents remember, and that we can still encounter in the archives, and it's still there in our culture, it's in our literature, it's in our painting, it's in our music. I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll. I mean, and I have to be because I've got grandkids. So, I'm in quite a privileged position. In one sense, the way the world's sorted out now suits me. If life is as Richard Dawkins, John Dawkins, two can go together as far as I'm concerned. if it's all about self-interest, then the way the world's organised now, there's no drama. If the planet becomes untenable because of climate change, which is a direct outcome of the way we organise ourselves as an economy, why should it bother me? I'll be dead before the worst of it comes, and I would have had the best of it. But that idea that you're going to suck the best of it out and leave everyone else to go hang, I'm not sure if I believe that people have that cold Ayn Rand. I mean, some people do, and we know that. Mm. We recognise them. They're in the media, they're in politics.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's the broad spectrum of humanity, and even perhaps a broad spectrum of lily-livered representatives. Eventually they'll get frightened enough to do something. Whether they do something about it in time to secure a future for our children is really the pressing point.
One last question. This is just an indulgent question on my side. As you drive down the coast to Perth or up the coast of Perth, or where, were you up? You north of Perth, or you?
Oh, I'm a long way north of Perth. Yeah. It's only a 14-hour drive.
Are you listening to books of the past, the books of contemporary writers? Are you all over the place? Are you reading, listening to non-fiction, fiction?
I'm listening to everything. You know, I'm quite promiscuous in my reading and in my listening. Sometimes I'm simply choosing out of, you know, completely pragmatic. What can I read in my journey? Particularly if I'm not making a really long journey on the road, very often, if I'm only doing it a couple of times or three or four times a year, you don't want to get halfway through a book and then be months before you listen to it in that conditions again. So I, you know, half the time I'm thinking, well, I need something about 12 hours, 10 hours. I need a little bit of music in between. Because I don't get out very often. I mean, out of the car. Once I'm on, I'm a bit like my father that way. Once I'm on the bitumen, or even dirt, if it's depending where we are, I'm hard to stop. You know, my wife will often say, you know, can we pull over? I need a pee. You know, well, you had one 4 hours ago. What's wrong with you? You know? So it tends to be, you know, it's about length. So I tend to choose according to length. Sadly, that means, you know, all you know, the great hefty Russian 19th century stuff and most of Dickens and George Eliot and things like that are a bit tough. But I listen to the short stories of Tolstoy and the shorter bits of Dostoevsky and little bits of Turgenev, if it's the classics in that way. But thankfully, most contemporary novels are a little shorter than that. There have been a few recent notable examples that are longer than any Russian novel, and sometimes I just wish they'd get a wriggle on, you know. I love being able to experience books in any form they take, really.
And you mean?
The idea of having to encounter. The Great Gatsby in interpretive dance, probably a bridge too far. So all forms except that, perhaps.
Tim, I've got a whole list of questions here, but I can't keep you all day. It's been wonderful chatting to you. Your new book is surprising and interesting, and it looks at the world, the Australian world, and your own personal world in, from different angles, from the politics as we're discussing, from boyhood and taking on the environment, and then sharks are in there, which both chapters scared the bejesus out of me. and little insights into the mind of the writer, which will interest the wannabe writers out there as well. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Oh, pleasure.
Tim's book, Boy Behind the Curtain, and all his other books are available at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.